Welcome to a bonus episode of the Health Report, which is on Ebola virus, given the current outbreak in the Congo and Uganda.
It's probably worth us just starting with the Ebola basics. Virus. Yes. What we are discussing, because we're talking about a group of viruses, the Ebola virus family.
A family of three, probably.
Well, six, but four are known to cause issues in humans.
Well, the Australian CDC says three. And a lot of the publicity. So it's a question of just how many variants might be. But you're right. I think the problem is families of viruses have lots of relatives, and some are disease-causing and some are not. And coronavirus is a classic example of that.
And it's worth pointing out that when you've heard about Ebola virus outbreaks before in Congo and other places before, it's often been the strain called Zaire or Ebola virus strain, and this is not what is causing issues in the Democratic Republic of Congo at the moment, and that is part of the issue here. But it's a group of viruses, very nonspecific symptoms, fevers,
to start off with anyway.
Chills, yes. People can have disruption of their coagulation or clotting pathways later, and they can develop clotting and bleeding. But it is a group of viruses that has a high fatality rate.
Up to 50%. But you can save people's lives with supportive care. So it's not inevitable, even when you've got hemorrhagic disease, that you're going to die, but it does need intensive supportive care. And one of the other problems with Ebola, which increases its infectivity, it's not a pandemic virus, but close contact and contact with body fluids and blood can spread the virus, is that the virus lingers in the body for a long time. So it goes into areas which are called immune privileged. So in other words, where the immune system doesn't get in. So the fluid in your eye, the testes, and a couple of other areas of the body where the virus can live and you'll potentially come out again and infect other people.
And that's why contact with any bodily fluids, including breast milk, saliva, that can transmit the virus, but also contact with someone who's recently died from Ebola. And this is why you might be hearing in the news about burial practices and why that might be playing into the current outbreak.
And we should just talk about that a little bit in terms of the West African outbreak about 10 or so years ago, a bit more than that actually now, where at least 11,000 people died. Some people say it's much more than that. Most of these estimates, by the way, are underestimates because this happens in the countryside, it happens with inadequate record keeping. And these viruses come out because of a conjunction of circumstances, social disruption, poor medical services available, in the case of the Congo, warfare, lack of trust in governments. And one of the ways they got this under control in West Africa wasn't just public health measures. It was actually cultural interventions. It was going door to door to reassure people that it was safe to say that one of my members of my family has this or is sick in the back room, so that healthcare professionals could come in and the person would receive, you're reasonably confident the person would receive help, so there was benefit to it. But it was a cultural solution as much as a medical solution which helped get it under control. But there have been many outbreaks since, and as you say, it's mostly the Ebola virus, the Zaire version, but this one, the Bundibugyo virus, is not so common but produces very similar symptoms and risk of death.
I had two patients ask me this week, is it the next COVID prayer? And I think it's important to say this is not transmitted by respiratory droplet. It's not airborne like COVID is. So it's not as easily transmissible. And also people are infectious with Ebola once they develop symptoms. Now, they might develop symptoms 2 to 21 days after contact, so there can be quite a long incubation time. But COVID, you transmit before you develop symptoms. The 48 hours before is what I usually say to patients. So this is a different entity. It transmits differently, but it is a serious issue at the moment.
And it transmits more commonly in overcrowded circumstances where there's poverty and where there's social disruption and where there's movement of people, such as refugees and so on. And in this case, you've just got highly disorganized communities because of the warfare that's going on.
Yeah, local militia groups, huge levels of poverty, overcrowding, lack of access to healthcare. All of this is just making the situation worse. Can we talk about animal hosts though?
Well, that's right.
Because where does it come from? You know, well, everyone goes from, bats and
well,
creatures.
Well, it starts in bats, fruit bats. But we are not the only animal species to get infected. Porcupines can get infected. Oh. And other animal species can become infected. And it's probably more common for people to be infected from sick animals. So animals get sick and die, and which is a bit like the Black Death, a bit like plague. So plague, when plague hit, the Black Death hit, and people got used to it, I mean, it lasted 300 years, that second pandemic of plague. People started to recognise when it was going to appear because animals started dying.
That was the sign.
That was the sign that animals started dying. And, of course, rats were the classic species because the fleas on the rats would jump. You'd get bitten by the flea. And then if you got pneumonic plague, it would spread through the respiratory route, which is why it became a pandemic. In this case, you can catch it from animals as well. So it is pervasive. And in that environment where you are moving around and housing may not be adequate either, you would potentially come in contact with these animals too. But again, it's the blood products and the body fluids of these animals which are the problem. When the people realised what a serious problem Ebola was, there was a lot of effort to develop vaccines.
In 1970s, yeah? That's when it was discovered.
It was discovered, but more later on. So in response to the big Ebola outbreak, a lot of effort went into vaccine development for Ebola, and they did develop vaccines that were effective. And there is one in store that uses a virus called VSV to carry in the virus antigen to stimulate the immune system. And the question is whether how similar the other viruses are.
Like the Bundibugyo strain.
Yeah, to the original one, and whether or not there's cross-reaction with the vaccines, and they simply don't know that. The research is not conclusive on that. At the moment, we just have to assume there's no treatment and no vaccine.
But the World Health Organization has said it could take up to 9 months to develop one for the Bundibugyo strain. So it may take time, and the prevention element to this is essential. So just to take us to where we're at now. At the moment, there are 600 suspected cases.
And by the time you're listening this bonus episode, it might well be more, and it's probably more already.
139 suspected deaths from Ebola. We think this originated in the Democratic Republic of Congo in a very densely populated area. It's now leaked into Uganda and possibly other neighbouring countries as well. When they were initially testing and seeing that people were getting sick, including healthcare workers, they were looking and testing for the Zaire strain or the Ebola strain, and it wasn't coming back positive. And so possibly there's been under detection. They eventually then went and tested for the Bundibugyo strain. And it's very likely that there has been a lot of silent spread, that this outbreak's numbers are much larger.
And a few years ago, this might well have been detected because USAID,
yes,
the international aid organisation, which is now defunct because it's been defunded in the United States, carried a lot of the burden of the monitoring and intervention in these areas, and it's disappeared. And ironically, an American doctor, but a missionary, not a USAID doctor, has become infected, and his wife may well have become infected too. We don't know that
yet. I think he's being monitored, but currently testing negative. The USAID part of this story is huge because when that was shut in 2025, 10,000 staff and nearly 30,000 staff around the world. See you later. Funding cuts. This is the first outbreak of this kind since USAID has shut down. And if USAID had been around and the outbreak was occurring, that's how you get the diplomatic pressure and muscle to go into these conflict zones, boots on the ground, interventions, and it is not the same response now.
And WHO comes in.
Yes.
Creating a situation of concern which actually activates an international response. But now that international response lacks the heft of the United States of America.
Because they removed themselves early this year. Funding, boots on the ground again.
And there is a selfish reason why a country should remain in WHO, remain as a contributor and remain involved, is that we live in one world. And
with porous borders, where global health should be the consideration. If we are all well, that should be the aim, not just some of us in the wealthier countries.
So during the West African outbreak, we were concerned, and some people, we had healthcare workers going overseas to help with that pandemic.
What year is this, the West African outbreak?
That's 2014. And we had healthcare professionals going over. I think we built field hospitals during that outbreak. We had field epidemiologists going out. One of the people we interviewed a lot during COVID, Kamalini Lokuge from the Australian National University, Tasmanian medical graduate, she was out there and she was doing those cultural interventions that I was talking about. But the concern was that people would come back infected. And we created an Ebola unit. And if I'm correct in remembering, it was at Westmead Hospital in Sydney, where people would be isolated and looked after in a specialised context. But, you know, bottom line here is, like, your patients, you know, there's Ebola, you know, the word about Ebola, the word about diphtheria and other, you know, hantavirus. There's a lot happening. Two messages. One is we are a member of the international community and we should care about that stuff and we should get involved, and Australia's not bad at doing that. But their threat to us as individuals is extremely low.
Yes.
It's not a pandemic threat, but you can get outbreaks. But we should really, our hearts go out to the people there in those difficult areas and hope that it comes under control as quickly as possible.
And the World Health Organization saying that it's a public health emergency of international concern, which is the level below a pandemic, is really so that they can put into place all the infrastructure that's required. The US has said that they are going to put 50 treatment centers on the ground, which has been heavily criticised, Norman, because that, of course, takes time to actually put those centres on the ground. And treating people with Ebola is not normally how you go with public health response. It should be on PPE, hand hygiene practices, addressing housing, prevention. Education. Yes. And so this is certainly a frightening time with all the changes to the World Health Organization, USAID. But I agree with you that we do hope that they get control of the situation.